From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. A vote in the House could come tomorrow on the Republican tax cut plan. And in the Senate, Republicans have unveiled changes to their plan that includes repealing the Affordable Care Act requirement that every American have health insurance coverage. Julie Rovner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, says the Congressional Budget Office found that eliminating that individual mandate would save about $338 billion over the next 10 years.
That's primarily because fewer people would have health insurance, so the federal government wouldn't have to pay the subsidies to help those people pay for their health insurance. In fact, CBO said that in 2019, 4 million fewer people would have health insurance, and by 2027, 13 million fewer people would have health insurance. And much of the health community is very concerned because it's only because of having healthy people in the insurance pool that they can afford to provide care for the sick. And they're worried that without the mandate, only sick people will sign up, and that will quickly make insurance premiums completely unaffordable.
Joining us now is NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Danielle, along with this proposal to repeal the ACA individual mandate, and we just heard about some of the possible consequences from Julie Rovner, what else is notable about this new Senate tax plan?
The Senate bill would now increase the child tax credit up to $2,000. That is a big jump. They had previously suggested raising it to $1,650. But another really, really important thing here is that it would end the cuts to individual taxes and really end a lot of the new provisions on the individual side at the end of 2025, whereas it would keep all of the corporate tax changes specifically, you know, that really big corporate tax cut, it would keep that permanently. Now, that is a really big deal. What you have here is this thing called the Byrd Rule, which is a set of provisions on the Senate side that say what they have to do, the sorts of math targets they have to hit. So these changes, you know, sunsetting those individual tax cuts is being derided by a lot of critics of the bill right now as creating gimmicks, as a math gimmick to just get the math to work out, and also being derided as, you know, prioritizing corporate tax cuts over individual tax cuts.
And what about the House plan? Where does that stand? We said there's going to be a vote tomorrow.
Right. Yeah. So the House plan, substance-wise, broad strokes, is pretty similar to the Senate plan. I mean, you do have this big corporate tax cut in the middle of it. You have lower rates for some individuals. You have an increase to the standard deduction. But on the vote side of things, Paul Ryan has said he's confident that the votes are there, that they really will be able to get this thing passed. That said, there's not full unification on the Republican side there. The representatives from higher tax states, Peter King from New York, for example, has been very vocal on this. They're upset about the potential elimination of the deduction for state and local taxes. That, of course, would hurt people, constituents in higher tax states, more than it would people in lower tax states. So they probably, as it looks right now, won't get the votes of all Republicans on this.
And the House Speaker Paul Ryan said today on CNBC's Squawk Box that the House will not address repealing the Obamacare individual mandate unless the Senate does so first.
It really is whether or not the Senate has the votes for this or not. So we're seeing what the Senate can do. If the Senate can get it through committee, if they can get it through the floor, then we'll meet them in conference and we'll assess at that time.
So that's the big question, Danielle. Does the Senate have the votes to pass a tax bill that repeals the Obamacare individual mandate?
As of right now, Senate Republicans seem pretty confident on that. Republican Senator John Thune from South Dakota is reported as saying that they've whipped the votes and that they really do think it can pass.
But there are also senators like John McCain who sunk the last attempt at healthcare overhaul, a repeal of Obamacare, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Jeff Flake, and Bob Corker, both in pretty public fights with President Trump right now. Will they vote for this plan?
This is where we kind of get into the realm of, you know, what they're not saying. And what a lot of those people on that list that you just ran off have not said is no, they haven't rushed forward to say absolutely not, we're not going to support this. Nor have they rushed forward to say yes, absolutely. I mean, what you've heard from them is somewhere in the mushy middle. You've heard Bob Corker and Jeff Flake. They told Politico that, you know, they could vote for this, for getting rid of that individual mandate penalty, if it makes it easier to pass the tax bill. Likewise, Susan Collins likewise told Politico that, quote, my concern is that if we combine the health care issues with tax reform, we make it far more controversial. So the concerns among those senators, what they've stated in some interviews, they've talked less about the substance of getting rid of the individual mandate penalty and more about the politics. Can it make tax reform easier or harder to pass?
And there are also two other things that fit into the politics of all this. One is the situation with Roy Moore in Alabama. And if he loses that seat and they haven't voted in the Senate on the tax plan yet, by the time that happens, that could lose Republicans another vote. And then we're also watching the trial, the corruption trial of Democratic Senator Bob Menendez in New Jersey. That could play into all of this as well. We'll keep an eye on it. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, conservative Fox TV host Sean Hannity is having second thoughts about his defense of Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore. He'd earlier suggested that accusations of sexual assault against Moore might be false, leading advertisers to drop out of his show. But during the show last night, Hannity said Moore had explaining to do.
You must remove any doubt. If he can't do this, then Judge Moore needs to get out of this race. This country has...
So, how is talk radio in Alabama tackling this? Five women now say Moore pursued or sexually assaulted them back in the 70s when they were teens, and he was an assistant DA in his early 30s. Moore's repeatedly denied the claims, and many listeners to talk radio in Alabama back him solidly. From member station WBHM in Birmingham, Andrew Yeager listened in.
It's quiet. The sun's not up yet. And the city lights poke through the windows at the studios of 105.5 WERC. Executive producer Wade Smith is checking several computer monitors to make sure everything's ready for this edition of Alabama's Morning News with JT.
It's just going to be a day where we don't really know what to expect, but we know where the show is headed.
In other words, Roy Moore is the only thing on people's minds. Host JT Nicewander launches right into it.
Good morning. It is 6 o'clock. I'm JT. It is time to get this Tuesday morning rolling. Is it time for Roy Moore to step aside?
They're just minutes into the show when producer Wade Smith answers the phone with an unexpected caller, Bill Armistead, Roy Moore's campaign manager.
Love days when that happens. Sometimes people just call us out of the blue from campaigns. So
they find time for him.
Joining us now, Bill Armistead, who is Roy Moore's campaign manager. Bill, good morning.
Good morning, JT.
Well, this is number five now as far as women accusing.
Armistead says Moore is innocent of allegations of sexual assault. He says Democrats and establishment Republicans have made it up to keep Moore out of Washington, and the campaign will prove it.
There's a lot of information that we believe is very credible that'll demonstrate that these charges are all cooked up. So All I can say, folks, is stay tuned. We're going to do our best to get it out there as quickly as we can.
All right. Very good. Bill Armistead, Roy Moore.
That's the campaign's official response. Moore supporters calling in are just as adamant.
So you believe all of this is fake news? All of this is false and it's
absolutely
all...
Absolutely. They did that with President Trump. They tried to do that with Jeff Sessions. They don't want him there because he does not give up.
For others, it's about not wanting to vote for a Democrat. In this case, Moore's Democratic opponent, Doug Jones.
I'm willing to vote for anybody rather than anybody
but Doug Jones. Ellen, what about if it's proven and she was 14 at the time, 40 years?
I don't care about that. Look, we lived through 8 years of a sexual predator in the White House. We had Bill Clinton and we all lived through it, didn't we? Including the Democrats.
Tony's got us on over there in Birmingham this morning. Tony, good morning. You're on Alabama's Morning News.
Hi, good morning. I have to wonder, where are all the other women over the last 40 years that he should have had some sexual misconduct with? Pedophiles don't usually change their M.O.
In the control room, the calls keep rolling in.
800 to learn
okay, what's your name?
Gold and safe haven assets.
Tim, hold on 1 second. Alabama's Morning News, you come about the Roy Moore situation? Okay, what's your name?
Be sure to ask about gold.
A few callers say the Moore story has made them too uncomfortable, and they'll write in someone or just won't vote. One says she was a Moore supporter, but it was the press conference with the fifth Moore accuser that changed her mind.
I put myself in her shoes at that age, and her statement is there's credibility to it, and I can't in good conscience vote for Judge Roy Moore. He really needs to withdraw at this point.
Most callers say they're sticking with Moore. Consistent throughout is distrust of the Washington Post, which broke the story, and Republican leadership.
And I think this is bigger than the judge now because
McConnell Frogface up in Washington wants to make sure that Trump doesn't have anybody up there to help him.
There's no doubt a big push from the Republicans, some in there that don't want him in there. Did she call him Frogface? I think I heard that. All right, that is it for us. Thank you all for the calls. I appreciate that. Glenn Beck is
host JT Nicewander says it's been this intense since the Republican primary, and he expects it to remain just as heated even after the special election December 12th.
It's Alabama politics at its worst, or best, depending on which way you look at it.
And plenty of fodder for talk radio. For Here and Now, I'm Andrew Yeager in Birmingham.
It's Here and Now.
I got rhythm, I got music, I got my gal, who could ask for anything more?
The as close to perfection as you are going to get, Tony Bennett, from the album Tony Bennett Celebrates 90. It was released last year. He's now 91, and the celebrations continue. Tonight, the Library of Congress will award Tony Bennett the 2017 Gershwin Prize for Popular Song, the first time this award has been given to a song interpreter rather than a songwriter. And boy, can Tony Bennett interpret a song.
I left my heart in San Francisco.
Then just this week, Tony Bennett's latest memoir, written with NPR Scott Simon, came out in paperback. It's called Just Getting Started. It's an homage to others who've inspired his journey from Queens, New York, to citizen of the world. So we thought we'd celebrate as well, remembering a recent visit. Last fall, we rode an elevator up into the rarefied air of Tony Bennett's fifth floor Central Park South studio, greeted by Tony's assistant and the man himself.
Thank you very much. Come on inside.
Yeah, well, here we are.
And we sat down with Tony Bennett to talk about his book, Just Getting Started.
I was so struck by the details. We learned that Pearl Bailey slugged a chorus girl, knocked her out on the stage.
She was making, trying to ruin the routine that she was doing on the stage, and she was heckling her from behind. You know, jealousy of playing with a big star like Pearl.
She slugged her?
Yeah, she just turned around and knocked her right out.
Nat King Cole was attacked by white supremacists on stage in Alabama.
It's tragic. You know, I'm so against any kind of prejudice. And he was such a beautiful man. In fact, he never recovered from that. When he went down, his back hit the back of the stage, and he was sick for the rest of his life. It was a very terrible situation.
So were others that you relate. I mean, you talk about how many African-American idols, how many blacks you worked with, couldn't go with you to, like, local restaurants when you were touring.
Oh, yeah. Well, Rosemary Clooney and I, we went to see a black artist in Washington, D.C., and after the show was over, we said, let's go backstage and congratulate the artist. And they said, well, you can't go backstage. He has to come out here to see you. And we were so angered. It's complete ignorance.
Well, it's interesting how much race figures into your book. I knew that Harry Belafonte had asked you to come to the Selma March to support King. I had no idea there was a volunteer who drove you around.
That's right.
A white woman.
That's right.
After
she
having
had five children.
She had five children. You leave. What happens to her the next day?
She was shot. Complete ignorance, you know.
I mean, it was just awful. She was pursued by members of the KKK in her car. They shot and killed her. You were in that car the day before.
Right. No, it's complete ignorance, you know. It's we all belong here. It's better than any other country in the world, you know.
I left my heart in San Francisco. High on a hill, it calls to me.
By the way, Tony's driver, the white mother of five killed by the KKK, was Viola Luiso. This book is about her, Frank Sinatra, Lady Gaga. Then there's Sadie Vimmerstetz, who wrote some words on a napkin. She mailed it to Johnny Mercer, songwriter, Los Angeles. Right. And he got it.
She wrote, "I want to be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart." And he liked it so much that he wrote the whole song for her.
I want to be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart.
If you're of a certain generation, you can't hear early Tony Bennett without thinking of your parents. Nighttime would come and you'd hear Tony Bennett, you know, singing "Because of You" on the stereo. You'd know all was well.
Because of you, there's a song in my heart. Because of you, my romance had its start.
For many of us, it's some of the sweetest memories that we have.
Well, you know, I want to tell you something that I don't think anybody knows this, but I'm telling you that what's phenomenal about my career is that I've never had an empty seat in all the times I've been performing. To this day, I'm sold out, and now because I'm 90, they give me 6 standing ovations a night.
What do you think it is?
Talent. I know that sounds conceited, but it's just knowing what not to do. When I first started out, some great performers like George Burns and Jack Benny met me, and I had the 2 biggest records in the country with "Because of You" and "Cold, Cold Heart."
I tried so hard, my dear, to show that you're my every dream. Yet you're afraid each thing I do is just some evil scheme. A memory from your lonesome past keeps us so far apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?
I was thrilled. I couldn't believe it. Jack Benny and George Burns. And they said, "Now you're doing great, kid, but you know what? It's going to take you quite a while to really learn what not to do." And funny enough, they were very accurate. It really took about 7 years to learn not to do too much on the stage, knowing when to get off, putting a little sense of humor into your show. And it really took 7 years to learn what not to do. I'm 90 years old, so it is a little sad when you realize a lot of great friends are gone and that I had beautiful days with when they were alive. Hopefully, if I get lucky enough, I could really live a lot longer. I'd like to live to about 105.
Oh, all I derive out of being alive, da-da-da, da-da-da, to 105.
I don't know what that head start. If you are among the very young at heart.
Amy Winehouse, left so young.
I know. When I saw and heard that she was in trouble, I was going to tell her to try and slow down, that it's you could get hurt if you drink too much. When I got to the studio expecting to see her, my son who manages me, Danny, came up to me and said, "We just found out she just died." I just started crying.
You know I'm yours for just the taking. I got me so you know myself to you, body and soul.
She was a very exceptional talent. She knew how to do it.
You say you blame yourself that you wished you'd said something, but In your long career, you know you probably can't stop someone. You know, they have to stop themselves.
Yeah, that's right. I had to stop myself. I went a little far out when I was younger, and I realized I'm cheating the audience.
You know, you dabbled in cocaine, but yeah, you stopped
but I just
it.
Stopped. There's one moment where I just stopped.
Just in time, I found you just in time. Before you came, my time was running low.
Do you ever sit back and think, how did this happen? You know, I was a kid from Astoria. Your mom sewed garments. Your dad died so young.
It happened because of my family. When my father died, I was 10 years old. So all my relatives, every weekend, they were all workers and we were very poor. And they would come over. And it was just a moment in my life at 10 years old when I just said, who am I? Is anybody ever going to know who I am? I was wondering who I was. But it was my relatives that told me who I was. They said, you're a singer and you're a painter. And boy, that did it. Because I said, that's who I am. Here I am, 90, but I feel like I'm just starting out because there's still so much to learn.
Oh, the good life, full of fun, seems to be the ideal.
Tony Bennett last fall. He's now 91. His book, Just Getting Started, is out in paperback this week. Tonight, he'll receive the 2017 Gershwin Prize for Popular Song.
Goodbye.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
This week, the Food and Drug Administration approved a digital pill, one embedded with a sensor that can send a signal to inform a patient's doctor that they're adhering to their medication. It's the first time a drug has had this technology, and it's getting a lot of reaction, including on The Late Late Show with James Corden.
Now, I still think it would be way more effective if they went with my plan of making all pills taste like cool ranch Doritos.
Joining us now is Rebecca Robbins, business reporter for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's great to be here.
So first of all, just describe what this medication is used for and how the technology works.
Sure. So this is a pill for schizophrenia and other mental health conditions. It's used for bipolar disorder and depression. It's been on the market for about 15 years now, sold as Abilify, a common antipsychotic drug. But what the drug makers behind this new technology have done is embedded the pill with a sensor that sends a signal to a patient's phone that tracks when and whether they took the pill. And patients can choose if they want to allow their doctor or caregiver to have access to that information as well.
And are there privacy concerns here?
There are. So there's certainly been concern raised since this approval about the implications of having such a tracking device. There's been particular attention to the fact that this has been approved for patients with schizophrenia, a condition that is sometimes associated with delusions or paranoia. This notion of having your pill taking tracked with that condition has raised some alarms.
And is the likelihood that this kind of technology will eventually be used in other pills?
I think that's very likely. There are other companies that are developing similar technologies in other conditions. One company is working on a smartphone-based visual recognition system. So that would give patients a way to document taking medicine. There's another ingestible sensor being tested with drugs for HIV, for opioids. So I think we're likely to have a new wave of these kind of digital medications. I think it's also useful to think about this and the way that the FDA is rethinking what a medication or what a treatment can be. For instance, earlier this fall, the agency approved the first smartphone app as a treatment for certain substance use disorders.
Now, a year and a half ago, the FDA denied approval for this medication. What changed?
So when the FDA first denied the drug, they had sought more information about how the product would be used, about how human error could be played in and affect the safety and efficacy of the drug. The company came back to them with more information, and a year and a half later, they finally got the approval.
And I think of this in the context of rising healthcare costs. I imagine it's more expensive to have a pill with a sensor like this than to have a pill without a sensor like this. Do we know how much these pills are going to cost?
So the company has not yet announced the official price of this upgraded pill. That's expected next year, closer to when the medication launches. However, it's widely expected that this will cost more than the old version of Abilify.
That's Rebecca Robbins, a business reporter with our partners at STAT. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you for having me on the show.
In the months since producer Harvey Weinstein was accused of rape and sexual harassment, other accusations have been lobbed at actor Kevin Spacey, comic Louis C.K., director Brett Ratner, and more. And all the accusations started on social media before they became headlines. Former Boston anchor Heather Unruh tweeted out her claim that Spacey molested a loved one weeks before she appeared on national television to say it was her 18-year-old son. So lawyers specializing in harassment, and yes, there are a lot of them, are increasingly going to where the claims start, online. And it's led to what may be the first lawsuit from an accused, director Brett Ratner, against an online accuser. We'll take that up in a minute. But what has been the role of lawyers in this new climate? Deborah Katz is an attorney with Katz, Marshall & Banks in Washington, D.C. She specializes in harassment and discrimination cases. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And when we ask what's going on with lawyers, you say they've been busy.
We have been busy. Everyone who is working in the space is experiencing a tremendous uptick in calls. Our phones are ringing off the hooks.
Yeah. So a shift in the landscape, would you say?
Yes, certainly in the kind of sectors that you're talking about, there has been a tremendous shift. Women are finally feeling it is their moment. They're feeling emboldened to come forward. And there is a sense that women will finally be believed.
Well, we're also reading, though, about lawyers who represent clients who might be, accused, who are aggressively, preemptively trolling social media to try to find accusations.
Yes, that's obviously going to be a moment of backlash as well. The reason that women are finally coming forward with Me Too campaigns is there's tremendous safety in numbers, obviously. And it is a much sweeter and faster form of justice to out a harasser than to go through many years of legal battle, which is psychically, emotionally, and financially exhausting.
You mean a trial?
So, correct. Filing suit, going through depositions, going through rigorous discovery. This is a much faster and sweeter form of justice. On the other hand, there's a backlash.
Right. Well, and also there are questions of legality. I mean, how much can you say about somebody online? So you have Martin Singer, the attorney who was recently profiled in the New York Times. He's one of those who has people trolling the internet for his many clients who reportedly include people like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And then he will contact people. How would that proceed if they find someone making an accusation on social media?
Typically, they'd send a cease and desist order. They'd demand a retraction. They'd demand an apology. And there would be a threat that if the person went forward with the allegations, didn't remove them, that they could be subject to a defamation libel suit.
Well, but we're reading that in some cases, the people making accusations might just post that letter. It adds fuel to the fire.
Yes, that's right. It is definitely a PR risk to send a letter like that. It may be perceived as a form of retaliation. It may be perceived as a form of intimidation. And that's something that has to be weighed very carefully. That's not my side of the equation.
Right.
I'm on the side of plaintiffs and women who are finally in a position to feel emboldened to speak their truth. They have to weigh that decision very mindfully. They know that there's risk involved. On the other hand, submitting to sexual harassment for years and living with the consequences of that is also tremendously painful and has its own significant damage. So women are making that calculation.
And staying with the online, they're doing it, as you said, without the other thing that often comes with a lawsuit, which is the accusation that they're just looking for money. However, there's the case of Melanie Kohler, who might have a chilling effect on this. She says she was empowered by the Weinstein accusations to say on Facebook, October 18th, she was raped by Brett Ratner, the film director, years ago. She said she just wanted to tell family and friends, but of course, others see Facebook as well. Someone contacted Ratner's attorney, who is Martin Singer. Singer called her, she says in a threatening way, told her to take the post down. She did. But now Brett Ratner and his attorney are suing her. This could be the first lawsuit against a complaint made online. So has that had a chilling effect on, you know, your work?
Well, I'm not seeing the chilling effect. Women are still coming forward in tremendous record numbers. Yesterday, there was a piece in the New York Times about women who are sexually harassed in Congress. I think this is a moment where people are weighing their risks and they're deciding that they will not submit to this in silence any longer. So obviously, a case like this might have a chilling effect, but we're not seeing it yet.
Yeah.
And good luck with that lawsuit, given the other allegations that have come forward.
Well, let's mention them. The LA Times reported on November 1st that six other women who've all come forward using their names have made similar charges against Brett Ratner. Back in December, I mean, this seems to be something that was burbling in Hollywood. Back in December, Tina Fey, speaking at the Hollywood Reporter's annual Women in Entertainment Breakfast, made a joke that, you know, Brett Ratner is here. In his defense, he thought this was a thing where you could eat breakfast off 100 women. So what is burbling up as has been happening in these cases is that it was a known secret. So
right.
how does that affect somebody who made a claim online?
Well, that's sort of the point. There's safety in numbers. Truth is, of course, an absolute defense to defamation. And who's a jury going to believe, given the number of other women who have come forward? Ratner is opening himself up to tremendous discovery, invasive discovery, into every aspect of his life and relationships with other people. And at the end of the day, he's not going to win this suit. So this is an intimidation tactic. It's designed to shut other women down who may want to come forward about him. And apparently it's not working.
And by the way, just is there a flat out, you know, legal answer to the question, what can you say online? I don't think we've come to one yet, but can you just, you know, make an accusation about somebody online? It is the new frontier.
If someone has been subjected to assault and sexual harassment and they are telling the truth about this, they may be threatened with a lawsuit. They may actually have a lawsuit filed against them. But they're weighing that risk, and there may be enough value to them psychically in not holding this secret, in coming forward, and other women then coming forward to support them, that they'll take that risk.
Is there an irony here that this woman just wanted to speak her truth? She wasn't looking for any money, and now she may be able to countersue Brett Ratner
Absolutely.
For some. Yeah.
Absolutely. She would certainly be able to file a countersuit.
What happens to a lawyer when the person you're on the side of, when their story starts to deteriorate?
Well, this is sort of the crisis management strategy we're all seeing. Roy Moore is threatening lawsuits against his accusers. Harvey Weinstein threatened lawsuits against the New York Times and his accusers. Where are the lawsuits? There are no lawsuits. They're intended to intimidate people and make others think about not coming forward. But at the end of the day, it's not a good legal strategy, and it is a very poor press strategy as well.
Well, you mentioned Weinstein, and we know, of course, that the Harvey Weinstein attorney, David Boies, who helped Weinstein hire private investigators, even intelligence firms, to gather dirt on Weinstein's accusers, at times intimidate them. He also, Boies, represented the New York Times. While the Times was writing about the Weinstein scandal, while Boies was also helping Weinstein hire people to squelch the New York Times stories, that's almost a third category of lawyers. I mean, you have some for the accused, some for the accusers. and some stirring the pot in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a perfect storm. And this is exactly why women historically have been scared to come forward, is because powerful, rich men can lawyer up and put together teams to crush the accusers. Well, it's not working here, but look, it's worked for 30 years for Harvey Weinstein. It's worked for a long time with Roger Ailes. It worked for a long time with Bill O'Reilly. And maybe we're at a moment where it's going to stop working. And maybe we're at a moment where lawyers of the stature of David Boies will not bring in the Mossad to investigate women who have allegations.
The Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency that he did hire to help squelch some of the Weinstein stories.
Yeah, I hope we're at the moment where the strategy of trying to absolutely annihilate the accuser is over. But I don't think so. That is the reflexive response of people who are accused of sexual harassment, even when the allegations are well-founded, completely meritorious, well-documented, and there's a barn of women coming forward making those allegations. The first response is to deny, and impugn the integrity of these women. And that's what's happening with Roy Moore right now.
Well, one thing is for sure, this is a very busy time for lawyers. Deborah Katz, an attorney with Katz, Marshall & Banks in Washington, D.C. Deborah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're following the news out of Zimbabwe, where the military has placed President Robert Mugabe under house arrest. That's according to the South African leader, Jacob Zuma, who says he spoke with Mugabe by phone. The Zimbabwean military seized control of state TV last night and said this is not a coup.
We wish to make it abundantly clear that this is not a military takeover of government. What the Zimbabwe Defense Forces is doing is to pacify a degenerating political, social, and economic situation in our country.
NPR's Eder Peralta joins us now from Nairobi, Kenya. Eder, what's going on in Zimbabwe? Is it a coup?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly has all the hallmarks of being a coup. Yesterday, armored vehicles rolled into Harare, which is the capital of Zimbabwe, and they blocked off the road to the headquarters of the Presidential Guard, and then they surrounded the president's house. And then it really became clear that this was a lot more than a show of muscle by the military. Very early this morning, when the military took over the state broadcaster, uniformed Major General delivered a statement in which he said that President Robert Mugabe was safe. He said that the military was just trying to bring criminals around Robert Mugabe to justice, and that once that was done, things would get back to normal in Zimbabwe.
And what led to this situation? How did we get here? Why is it happening now?
Yeah, I mean, this has been building for quite a while now. And it's really all about who is going to replace President Robert Mugabe. He's 93 years old, and he became president in 1987. And two leading candidates emerged. The first one is Grace Mugabe, who is Robert Mugabe's much younger wife. And she's really cultivated power in Zimbabwe. She was named the head of the ruling party's Women's League, and she has the loyalty of the wing of the party that's called the G40, and they're basically the younger wing of the party. And then you have Emmerson Mnangagwa, and he goes way back with Mugabe. He fought alongside him during the liberation fight to bring an end to the minority white rule in Zimbabwe. And until this month, he was Robert Mugabe's vice president, and Mugabe fired him earlier this month. And that was widely seen as Mugabe's move to name Grace Mugabe as his vice president. One thing that's worth noting is that as Emmerson Mnangagwa left Zimbabwe earlier this month, he said he would be back, but this time it was to lead the country.
I was watching some reaction from people in Zimbabwe to what's going on, and one person did say, I'm glad the military is doing this. Mugabe was treating Zimbabwe like it was owned by his family. How are people in Zimbabwe reacting?
You know, from the people I've spoken to, they say people are glad that this is happening. You know, one of the things that's been happening in Zimbabwe is the economy has just been really suffering. And obviously, you know, Mugabe has been in power since 1987. So he is the only president a lot of people have ever known. But practically, it's hard to believe that things will actually change because the military is part of this same generation that Mugabe comes from.
Now, you're joining us from Kenya. How are other leaders around Africa and other leaders around the world reacting to what's going on?
There's a lot of concern. The big one is South Africa, because they're the powerhouse. They're the ones that have the military to do something about this if they need to. And they have expressed concern, and they say that they do not want this to turn into a coup. And they are sending envoys to Zimbabwe to try and negotiate some sort of deal between the military and Robert Mugabe.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Embassy in Harare has advised U.S. citizens in Zimbabwe to shelter in place until further notice. How dangerous is the situation right now for foreigners in Zimbabwe?
It's tense. You know, the people I've spoken to say there's tanks on the streets. There are no police on the street. And the military is sort of directing traffic. You know, this hasn't been a very violent takeover of power. There were some explosions heard last night. But for the most part, the capital, Harare, has been peaceful.
Is there any talk, and as you mentioned, Mugabe's been in power there since the 80s, is there any talk about what the country would be like without him?
That is the question that a lot of Zimbabweans are asking themselves. If we take what the ZANU-PF, the ruling party, has said, is they say that their new president is Robert Mugabe's old vice president. And he's a liberation hero. He is, in a lot of ways, would be a continuation of what Robert Mugabe has stood for. So I think it's really hard to imagine a Zimbabwe without Robert Mugabe, because he has loomed so large, not just in Zimbabwe, but in this region.
That's NPR's Eder Peralta joining us from Kenya, talking about what could be a coup going on in Zimbabwe. We'll keep following the developments there. Eder, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.